All right, hello everyone. So I think what we're really here for is not just what can you do from a solar system probe for exoplanets. I think we're here to figure out what's new, what's cheap, and what's near term in exoplanets without having to go all the way to a space mission. And I think we've been talking about how to accomplish that in various approaches to studying exoplanets and microlensing. The answers to this question are the global networks are being set up and the discussions we've had about imaging from planetary missions. The radio velocity observers have an answer to this new cheap and near term. They're building new telescopes with private funding. They're thinking about new instruments to improve their measurement capabilities. For combined light, we've heard the same discussion. Ground and space telescopes are being used, the ones we have, and we've had discussions here about quick and dirty planetary mission observations that might be able to push the field forward a little bit. Astrometry, we haven't talked about much here. All I'm really aware of that's new, cheap, and near term is what the VLTI is doing for measuring planetary wobbles. And what I wanted to concentrate on in this talk is, which I think is the ultimate objective of all exoplanet research, is to get us to that direct imaging point of view where we can make spectra of planets like the Earth in the habitable zone. What's new, cheap, and near term for high contrast imaging that we can do that's not already happening? All that's happening right now is near-infrared coronagraphs are being deployed to ground-based telescopes listed here, and we will have JWST coming up. But as I'm going to try to tell you here, I think there's more we can do. So, first thing I just want to... Okay. So I just want to remind you, as you're interested in exoplanets, don't forget component number 3 of an exoplanetary system. The terrestrial planets, of course, are ultimate objective. Jovian planets, and the dust. The dust is component number 3. The dust is the largest surface area object in a planetary system in terms of being able to reflect and emit radiation. It's got more luminosity than a Jovian planet or a terrestrial planet does, unless that Jovian planet is parked in it, you know, half an AU or closer in. So this is the brightest object we have a chance to observe if we can use the right techniques to look at it. And of course, the linear scale is shown here, and I'm going to return to this point further later on, but the contrasts that you have for imaging and scattered light are quite different between these. A terrestrial 10 to the minus 10, a task for a TPF someday. A Jupiter is 10 to the minus 9 in reflected light. For a mature system like in ours, if it's at 5 AU. And out here, these can be quite a bit brighter than those numbers, so they can be easier, more accessible targets, as is evidenced by the fact that we have some images of debris disks around other stars already. So debris disks, you've heard some about from Chaz already, residual particles from grinding of planetesimals, collisions producing them continuously. The particles created right now will be blown out or dispersed within a few million years, so they have to be recreated constantly. And there's probably 1,000 debris disks known according to online catalogs these days. All this is dust out in the Kuiper Belt region. And most debris disks look like this. By that I mean that they are an infrared spectral energy distribution. The presence of the debris disk being shown here as an excess emission here, this is wavelength in microns, it's 100 microns. This is the photosphere of the star, and so we have this extra infrared emission. And most debris disks are only known through this, because that's the way they're most easily detected. Their contrast against the star is very favorable, because they're cold out there at temperatures of 150K or so. And so when you get this excess emission, you can learn pretty much only two things. What's the total luminosity in the infrared? And then what is the characteristic temperature of that dust? And then once you have that, it's not quite clear what kind of a system you have, because the relationship between the temperature you see and the orbital location of that dust is degenerated with what you assume for the dust properties. So here's a graph from Kate Sue's paper last year on the triple planet system HR 8799. And what this is meant to show here is here's the temperature. If you know that from that SED that we just looked at, that the temperature is 150K, well, what radius does that correspond to? Well, in this system in AU, it depends on what grain size you pick. If you pick medium-sized grains, then the radius is going to be over here at like about 4 AU. If you pick black-body grains with these large circles here, then it's going to be a little further out. And then if you pick very small silicate grains, it's out further still. So you have an uncertainty in about a factor of 3 in where that dust is for giving the same temperature you see in the far infrared. Then if you go out to even colder temperatures, the degeneracy is even worse. So from this SED information alone, you are unsure where the dust is. And you really want to know where the dust is, because that tells you a comparison to our Kuiper belt. Is this solar system out there like ours, or is the stuff in a different radial location than ours? And if you are able to measure the location of the dust through a resolved image, then you break this degeneracy. You know where on this curve you are for 150K. If you see the size of the dust is at 10 AU size, then that tells you not only the location, it tells you what particle size characteristically you're looking at. So we need imaging information to untangle these SEDs and figure out where the dust really is. But there's more than just that, which is that the dust will have some complex structure that traces what planets may be nearby and what they're doing to it. Well, first of all, if you see a dust cloud, it might be edge-on, it might be face-on. It establishes the inclination of the system. That's important for interpreting data like radial velocity. And it provides this whole field of thousands of and billions of small test particles that all respond to the dynamical influence of a planet. We're trying to look at this giant thing, a star, responding to the dynamical influence of a planet, and it hardly moves at all. Well, if you look at really tiny things, they're going to respond much more readily to the dynamical influence of the planet, and you can see that in the case of images. In this case, it's theory going all the way back to the late 1990s, predicting that depending on where you put the planet and where you put the dust, you can get complex structures that are resonant to it with the same orbital, same major axis or exterior to it, or you can get 3-2 resonances here. So a whole zoo of possible dust interactions with the planet can be worked up theoretically. And if you measure these, you can get some constraints on the orbit of the planet, mass of the planet, even if you don't see the planet. So at great distances from the star, this is probably one of your more sensitive ways of measuring planets at tens and hundreds of AU. And Chaz just showed you this image already. In the case of Fomalhaut, it's not very dark in here, so it's hard to see that. You saw it already. This is the eccentric ring, whose geometric center is here, but the star is offset from it because of the fact that the ring is not only eccentric because of projection, but eccentric intrinsically if you viewed it from overhead. And the planet seen in these images taken over a separation of 2 years is moving right inside the inner edge of this, sculpting the inner edge of the belt. So this is the kind of proof we finally have now, just in the past couple years, of what all the dynamicists were telling us in the 90s, that yes, we can use the dust distribution to infer where the planet is and what kind of mass it has. And so this is the kind of thing that I think we can do a lot more of if we can image more debris disks at high resolution. So the other example of this, the three planets around HR 8799 here in Christiane Marwah's ground-based picture, the spectrum of each of them shown here, this is also a system with a very prominent debris disks. So these imaged planets are both in debris disk systems. And the SED of that one looks like this, with the Spitzer photometry up here, the Spitzer spectrum shown there. The noise gets very big here because you're trying to subtract off the bright photosphere emission so that fluxes are getting very small. But just from this, you could tell there were two dust components, an outer cooler component about 150K, and a warmer component, outer cooler component 45, inner component at 150K. And these are separate and distinct, and you can get these approximate fits for the location, and it does allow this dust to be both to the inside and the outside of where the observed planets are, with this cartoon being representative of the configuration that's thought to exist. So the dust location tells you where the planets can be in the system. So the better we can establish the dust location, the better we can zero in on where planets should be searched for. Chaz also referred to this system. This is a nearby K-star that has three planets of Neptune sort of mass inside of 1 AU. There is a dust excess emission, and the modeling that Casey List did inferred that it was exterior to all three of these, and you can do dynamical analyses to show that this dust location would be stable at any of these positions here. And so there's no image of this to confirm it. We only have the inference of where this dust is, and we very much like to know, for example, is this slightly eccentric? As it might indicate interactions with still other planets in the system. We don't have an image of this system yet. Two more examples of debris disks where a planet is present in the system and they may be interacting. Epsilon Eridani, we've got a quite detailed study of this from Backman 2009. But the Spitzer data is very approximate on this system. We only have 8 arc second resolution images here. And so this, which is 25 AU, and you see the scale. So we only have a very indistinct picture of this from Spitzer that's been worked out. But the planet that's known in close here is very close to a small dust belt at about 3 AU. And so this is presumably interacting with the planet. The planet cannot have an eccentric orbit, has been claimed by some folks. It needs to have a much more circular orbit in order to be compatible with the existence of this inner dust belt. So the location of the dust belt is a constraint on where the planets are. And this system has got a very poorly known radial velocity orbit because it's such a very active young star and a lot of radial velocity noise. And then finally, Beta Pictoris is the first debris disk ever imaged, edged on around an A star. We just had a claim at the end of 2008 about a planet being located very close to the star in here at about only arc second or so separation. It has not been recovered, this planet. The inner part of the Beta Pic disk is somewhat depleted in dust, but there is still warm dust in there in addition to the planet. So it's actually a bit of a problem how this planet could be in there and still not have destroyed the inner dust component of the disk. Right now, this planet has not been confirmed. So studies of the disk and the compatibility with the existence of the planet still need to be worked out. So, and there's a whole bunch of other debris disks I won't talk about in any great extent. You can see their images on the web. They range from edge-on systems to, you know, very nice narrow rings, which are very suggestive of some kind of interaction with the planet. Edge-on ring in this case. Here's a system where the interstellar medium is blowing across the disk and causing some of it to be blown back and escape from the system. So while you may think from all these images that, wow, I've got lots of debris disk images, this is all figured out, the answer is no, we don't really have that many. The total number that are available at any wavelength, when I made this table, was 21, but there are 3 more that came out today with the Herschel results, early results now coming out. Out of these, a lot of them are resolved at long wavelengths, and only about 14 at very high resolution where you can see the structure quite well. And scatter light in space shown here, other techniques, submillimeter, will resolve it in some cases. Ground adaptive optics has a good deal of trouble, only sees the very highest dust density. Here's the fractional luminosity. So the ground AO can see the high dust density systems, and then ones that are edge-on, like these two, or confined to extremely narrow rings, like that one. So ground AO hasn't been as successful as space in seeing these, just because it's very difficult to see a fuzzy extended source against a PSF halo. Oh, blank means I haven't seen any report of an observation attempted for that object, whereas if it was attempted and not seen, then I put an N there. So where is progress going to come on resolving more debris disks and seeing their structure and using them to infer planet masses, locations, and so forth? Well, Herschel, we just had a conference on the first results from Herschel a couple of weeks ago back in Holland. Herschel has a much larger aperture, so superior resolution to Spitzer, still only 4 arc seconds at its shortest wavelength of operation, 70 microns. And the large surveys are being done with Herschel of nearby stars, including lots of targets that would be relevant for TPF or Darwin. There are 3 newly resolved debris disks in the Herschel first results. A couple of those papers are on AstroPH now. There's a third one, I think, about to appear. And they show a couple of disks that are actually quite small, Kuiper belt size. But also, there's one large one here. This is a ring that we can see with an HST image, and here it's extended at 70, 100, and 160 microns. This is the submillimeter ground-based observation in comparison. Still only 4 arc seconds, 6 arc seconds, and 8 arc seconds kind of resolutions here. Another path toward progress in debris disk imaging is going to be the ALMA submillimeter telescope, which is being put together in the Andes in South America. In the continuum, ALMA will be able to map several nearby debris disks to reasonably higher resolution. In this case, it's a model of a disk at 15 parsecs, something comparable to Fomalhaut, with a 0.4 arcsecond resolution. That's the model, that's the synthetic observation after all the noise sources are included. So for the few systems that are bright enough, Alma's gonna have some very nice maps. But the bad news is that very few disks are bright enough in the submillimeter for doing this kind of observation at this kind of resolution. Lower resolution observations, if you don't attempt to resolve it as much, you can get a higher quality detection. But I think, in general, Alma is not going to be producing sub-arcsecond resolution of a large number of nearby debris disks.
How many do you estimate?
Well, these, if you just go by the submillimeter fluxes that are observed, Fomalhaut is one of the brighter submillimeter objects. And so that one, I think they'll get a very nice observational result on. But the looking at it, they've only had detections in the submillimeter of about a half a dozen debris disks like Fomalhaut. So I think we're talking about numbers on that order for debris disks. For protoplanetary disks, which are at much greater distances, they'll have very much more dust, very high surface brightness. Alma will be the best instrument for study of those. But in debris disks, which are starved for material and that are very spatially extended because they're nearby, you're going to get these high quality sub-arcsecond maps, I think, for half a dozen sources. And then JWST is going to be a player for debris disk studies. The suggestion here is that we don't quite know yet how well it will do, because there's an issue here for a model observation of how stable is the wavefront of JWST with all those panels of the primary mirror. If they change position when the telescope slews relative to pointing at the disk target and then relative to pointing at a comparison star, then what'll happen is observations, the noise from wavefront measurements will get worse and worse and worse. So here's a very bright disk, three times Beta Pictoris. So this is about as bright as a debris disk gets in this model. And so if we go and put a small amount of wavefront error in it, and then we go and divide it by a factor of 50, so now this becomes more typical, a 10 to the minus 4 fractional luminosity disk. With a small wavefront error, we'll see it. With a medium-sized wavefront error, it's going to be very hard to see it, but it's there. And then if it's a larger range of wavefront error, then this is going to be impossible to see it. And the stability of JWST is something we're just going to have to wait and see on orbit. I think there's some new results on the predicted wavefront stability compared to when John Crist did the simulation in his 2008 paper. But as Chaz said earlier, for scattered light imaging, JWST isn't likely to go and get and show us disks that were missed by Hubble. The wavefront quality just isn't going to be good enough to do any better than Hubble. So it's not going to add much to the inventory of resolved disks in scattered light. Although there will be this important observation in the 3 to 5 micron region, not really probed yet by any imagers. Be able to get constraints on the dust particles and hopefully see ice features in this wavelength region on disks that are already known and observed and extended. There's also thermal imaging where the beam size is going to get quite big, and there should be a few dozen sources that can be resolved that way. And again, Fomalhaut is going to look really good, as Chaz showed. So those are all, that's the environment of what's happening with other systems for debris disk studies. So what can we do that's, you know, sort of new and cheap that doesn't, you know, isn't already being done by those other systems? So Chaz showed this chart before, again, showing the disks getting brighter to this direction, fainter to that direction, two different colored hatched regions, one for stars with planets and one without. And you can disregard that largely because there's no significant difference in the frequency of disks with stars with planets or without, or even in the strength of them. But the main point is that as you go to lower and lower disk luminosities, the fraction of stars that have a disk, a Kuiper disk, is going up and up and up. And this boundary here is about the boundary where we are now for scattered light imaging of disks. Disks that are to the right, we've seen examples of those that I've shown you, the fractional luminosity bigger than 10 to the minus 4. Disks to the left, where most of them are the ones we can't see in scattered light right now, because our imaging contrast isn't good enough. And so if we could just push this over by a factor of 10 in contrast, then we would probably increase the number of disks resolved in scattered light by a factor of 10. And that would make a huge difference in terms of how many systems we could study, and then study what was happening in their outer regions with Neptune-like planets perturbing the disks. And so this is, I think, what should be our goal, to get to more tenuous disks, not at 10 to the minus 4 or 1,000 zodies, but get it down to 100 zodies, 10 to the minus 5. So under the support of the TPF project, the now defunct TPF project, I mean, at JPL, a lot of effort was spent into getting coronagraph demonstrations in a vacuum tank with wavefront control and demonstrating contrasts of 10 to the 9 inside dark hole regions close to a simulated star. And so this is now done in 10 and 20% bandwidths, and it's been longstanding for several years now. And so far, it hasn't been bettered by alternate coronagraph techniques. And so eventually, this is one of the major competitors for a TPF architecture. And we realized that TPF coronagraph wasn't going to happen anytime soon. So what could we do to get this technology out of the lab and into getting astronomical results? Well, what we did several times now is propose a probe scale kind of mission based on a 1.5 meter telescope, and other groups have proposed this too with slightly varying coronagraph designs. And the goal of these was to try to see giant planets, Jovians, in reflected light, and it would also be able to do quite a bit of debris disk imaging down to sort of the 10 zodi level in nearby stars in scattered light. So we've made a good effort of trying to get this proposed, and the design has evolved, and the costing is better understood, and so forth. But even this backup plan to a coronagraph TPF, we now are too pessimistic to think it's going to happen anytime soon. We don't know when there's going to be an exoplanet probe opportunity. We don't know if it's going to be sufficiently funded to do something like this. We don't know if this will happen either. So we need still another near-term option to pursue. And I'm going back to this diagram of the overall system. The angular scale of this canonical system at 10 parsecs, has the Jupiters at half an arc second, the Earth's at 0.1 arc second. And so if you want to ask what telescope size do we need to study these things, if you wanted to do the Earth, it's an 8-meter telescope. That's what TPFC was originally intended to be. If you want to do Jupiter's, then this angular scale, 1.5-meter telescope would work. But now if you're going to make your target objects out here in the outer solar system, the debris dust, then you can, in terms of resolving something, making it 3 lambda over d separated from the star, you only need a 0.2 meter telescope to do that, in the optical wavelengths anyway. And in the infrared, it's all much harder. So let's concentrate on that. What could we do with a small telescope now, not in space, but on a balloon? And now Wes is the leader of a project just proposed for a coronagraph on board a stratospheric balloon. And the hope is, as demonstrated with some tests, at least the atmospheric turbulence is not significant at this altitude, so it should be much better than on ground adaptive optic system. Should approach what you can do from a space platform. And at visible wavelengths with 1 meter as a telescope size in the proposal here, deploy a coronagraph instrument that has the precision wavefront control that I just talked about, operating at optical wavelengths. And then because our target is an extended surface brightness, you don't lose by going to a small telescope, as long as we aren't resolving the disk in a very, over-resolving it greatly. If the disk is still bigger than our spot, our diffraction spot, we're still gathering in lots of light from the disk, even in a large beam, and so we're not losing in terms of contrast or even sensitivity to extended surface brightness by going to a small telescope. So in this respect, the debris disk targets are a good match to the inner working angle, because we don't need to go in to half an arc second or 0.1 arc second. You can study debris disks in a relatively small amount of observing time. You can do a couple targets a night of balloon flying. And then in terms of the contrast, we don't know what contrast we can achieve, but we've proposed a much less ambitious contrast than the space missions, where we needed 10 to the 9 contrast for exo-Jupiter. Here, 10 to the 7 contrast proposed debris disks are well suited to that contrast. And so this proposal was just submitted a couple months ago, and Wes could talk to you a great deal more about it, but I wanted to say just a little bit more about, so what science target set is available to an instrument like that. So the first thing you do is you go to what Spitzer has found. Spitzer has done a reasonably complete survey of nearby stars for infrared excess, although the further away you get, the less complete it is. And there's 108 stars with infrared excess within 40 parsecs of the sun. And so we can actually go from their infrared luminosity to estimate what their scattered light luminosity is just by assuming a value for the albedo. And so I've chosen 10% here, which is a value that is coming out of our Spitzer studies combined with HST of the brightness of scattered light we see in those systems. Now, I talked to you earlier about how the size of the disk isn't known from just the SED. So if we're going to assess what we can do with a high contrast imager, we have to make some estimate of the size. And so what I did there is assume that we had smallest dust particles were a few times the radiation pressure blowout size. Really small particles should be pushed out. Really big particles will kind of stay put. This is also a result we're getting from modeling Spitzer and HST data in combination, that we don't see particles as small as the blowout size. They're actually a few times bigger than that for the minimum size particle. So if you then assume that size particle and then do thermal equilibrium, you have a temperature estimated from the Spitzer data. I showed you that earlier. So take the temperature here, take this estimated particle size, and then you can work out what radius around the star, just a typical radius, that the dust might be found at. And of course, we want to get the measurements to show what that radius really is. But this is just for the purposes of demonstration of the small coronagraph. We don't know the radial distribution of dust either, because that's one of the things you want to find out by imaging the system. But there are enough infrared SEDs to show that a black body fit is a reasonable explanation for a lot of the SEDs. So that's consistent with a relatively narrow ring. And so we adopt a ring geometry similar to Fomalhaut with a 0.2 ratio of the ring width to the ring radius. And the disk inclination is also something we don't know, something to be established from actually getting the images. But the median value for random orientations is 30 degrees from edge on, so we'll do that in the simulation here. So from all these assumptions, I can go and calculate models for what the scattered light brightness should be in these 208 debris disks that Spitzer has found. So I've got a big tabulation that goes lots of rows off into the floor here for all these objects here sorted from nearest to farthest distances and going on out, and Spitzer survey results, fractional luminosity, which we use to scale into the brightness. So we've done a lot of busy work there, and we've turned that busy work into disk image models. Now, there are some systems where we have some information already to show that they're edge-on, or if they're at a particular inclination from HST. So those have been dialed in with their specific properties, or this one here. This is another one that's known to have a large radius. For all the others, I've just put them at this 30 degrees from edge-on inclination, and then we've gone and calculated, gone and measured what the contrast is in this model relative to the star in the center. And then the money result from that is this diagram. So I'll spend a couple minutes on this. So what's shown here is the predicted size of the disk, assuming it's this ring model, in arc seconds. Every target's at a different distance. And then here's the contrast that we would expect to see in a diffraction-limited spot for our 1 meter telescope. So then the stars that we have to look at are various brightnesses. So the brighter ones are faster to observe, because the counts on the disk, its reflected light, are proportional to the brightness of the star. So the bigger circles are going to be observed in shorter time. And the smaller ones are faint, will be harder to look at. And then now, here's the region where we're aiming to produce the balloon coronagraph performance. This is the inner working angle, probably half an arc second, which is very conservative, aimed to not require the balloon to do too much precision pointing. This is the outer working angle, which is determined by how big our deformable mirror is. And here's the floor of the observing, where 10 to the minus 7 is the how faint we think we can make the speckles. And then by subtracting the PSF, we think we can get about another order of magnitude. So within this bowl is a set of targets, it's about 4 dozen, that we think we could capture with this balloon coronagraph of the kind described. Now, the key thing is, how does that compare to what's already been done and is doable with other facilities? Well, first, here's the same diagram here. After PSF subtraction, this is what the Hubble Advanced Camera coronagraph was able to do. I'll remind you that coronagraph no longer works. So this is a historical sensitivity now. If it was above this level, then Hubble could detect it. If it's below its level, it could not. And here these solid objects show, these are disks that actually have been imaged by Hubble. And then over the other key comparison here is what can ground-based adaptive optics do? The Gemini Planet Imager, the Sphere coronagraph, those are on 8-meter telescopes. So this curve is taken from the Gemini Planet Imager webpage, again assuming PSF subtraction. And so they can go in closer, much bigger telescope. They're operating at 3 times longer wavelength than we would operate with this coronagraph on the balloon. But they still go in closer because their aperture is so big. Then they will be able to get the stuff as faint as this, and then outside of that, their sensitivity stops as well, because they are also limited by the finite size of their deformable mirror. So this curve would jump up and make a little bowl right here. And so the assessment from all of this, and there's some assumptions put in, the assessment is that we've got quite a substantial number of uniquely accessible targets for a small balloon-borne coronagraph that's going after debris disks. Now, we'd love to go after Jovian planets, but the contrast is down here. And we'd love to go after terrestrials, but the contrast is down here, and they're too far over. These are the ones where I think a near-term direct imaging effort can get us some science and also explore the techniques we need to get a coronagraph version of TPF to do. Well, this number is like about 3 or 4 dozen. We have to go and calculate observing times for each one of them. Some of them are faint, so it would take a long time. In a single flight, you'd probably be able to do about 2 or 3 targets. So you'd have to pursue all of this, you'd need to have multiple flights. And then the hope is that by imaging these guys, that then you start to see more systems like Fomalhaut with clear evidence for dynamical interactions between the disk morphology that you see and the presence of a planet. So, I mean, the summary points from all this is that, don't leave out debris disks in terms of the future studies of exoplanets. I mean, they are the outer solar system component we can see the most. And I believe we've convinced ourselves, and maybe we'll convince the review panel, that there's unique high contrast science to do on debris disks from a balloon at relatively modest cost. Not to say there aren't challenges, too. The pointing is better. Then for this is needed is better than what balloons have done in the past. So some development work is needed, but the folks at Wallops flight facility seem eager to pursue that. And then this opportunity, if it's going to happen, requires sort of greater awareness on the part of the whole community that the opportunity is there, just in the sense that balloons haven't typically tried to do high contrast observations before. And high contrast hasn't really tried to deploy on such a small platform before. The scientific balloon program will be stretched to support this project in any 1 year, so it's a question of whether they can be lined up behind it too. But I think there's an opportunity here that we haven't really recognized until the past few months, and this was an outgrowth of the KISS workshop, where we asked ourselves, what in all these different areas, what near-term cheap things were possible. So here's something we think is possible, and that's... I'll leave Wes to answer that.
I think it's for 4 years and 2 balloon flights.
Those are balloon flight out of Mexico.
New Mexico. Overnight. You want me to continue advertising? The design of the instrument is such that it is headed for ultra long duration flights that we can do in the southern hemisphere, launching from Australia or from Argentina and going around. But in the short term, those don't exist. So we know that we can do good work in the northern hemisphere.
We're working on that to make it happen.
Right. Yeah, but we're not predicated upon that. We can do good work from the northern hemisphere.
It would be a perfect target. In fact, where selection you should push for that, because you will be the test case.
Yes, but in the proposal, we de-emphasized it because we didn't want things to depend upon it from that point of view.
No, that's exactly if you're selected.
Okay, Chaz. Not to put you on the spot, but given the informal nature of this,
You made predictions of this kind for Spitzer on the things we thought would be the resolvable dirty dozen or whatever we called them at the time. And the ones you thought we could resolve, we didn't resolve. And the ones we actually resolved were a completely different set of stars. So what did we learn from Spitzer that now helps us do, we hope, a better job of actually predicting the sizes?
Well, the main thing we're doing here is we're combining HST scattered light and Spitzer in the analysis. So what Chaz is referring to is before Spitzer launched, we tried to figure out which disk should be the most resolvable. And we thought A stars would be the most resolvable disks. But it seems like that didn't turn out that way. One of the nearby targets that I was really confident would be resolved extended wasn't, because the particles just apparently are larger than I had assumed. I had assumed smaller particles. So we now know from Spitzer that small particles are rare in debris disks. There are very few systems that have 10 micron features or 20 micron features indicative of small particles. And then we also now have been able to calibrate versus HST data in three different systems for not only what radius the Spitzer emission is coming from, but then in addition how bright what the albedo is from the HST observations. So I wouldn't say that these size predictions are foolproof. There are a lot of disks that weren't on that diagram because the prediction was they would be too big. So some things could be brought back in if those are wrong. Bottom line is we just need more disk size measurements to understand this.
Now, has Herschel helped with that in some sense? Do you think resolving that outer disk is going to really start break that degeneracy of size of grain and size of disk?
Well, we have a couple different papers based on Spitzer results where we have an extent measured with Spitzer and have been able to work out what the grain sizes are there. And there's this consistent picture that the grains aren't as small as they could have been according to the blowout size argument. So that means the disk isn't as big as it could have been because the grains are more like 5 to 10 microns in an A star and then more like a few microns in an FGK star. So I think we're just smarter about this now than we were prior to launch. And the Herschel observations will certainly help tell us what the extent of these disks would be. So a lot of the ones that are in this 40 parsec list, so we're going to have Herschel size constraints on during the next couple of years. And so we'll be able to revise these numbers if needed.
Okay, well, I had a question. So this balloon program doesn't, strictly speaking, fit into the category of doing exoplanets with solar system missions. But it might fit into the sort of the point that Chaz made earlier about, sort of science that falls in between the cracks, and that's one of the things that we're going to address. And so, but I'm not entirely clear whether
I think this should be our conference name, this workshop name, rather than what comes from planetary missions. Yeah, planetary is a major component of it, but I think this is our real charter.
Well, I mean there is a formal, the ExoPag sort of, is supposed to do what it's tasked to do by the Astrophysics Subcommittee of the NAC, and so we do have.
We're interpreting the solar system in a very broad sense to include the Earth.
Okay. Well, I guess my question though is whether whether there's real a problem of sort of falling in between the cracks here, or whether existing programs can support something like this. And I mean, sort of vaguely think that there've been programs and large, relatively expensive balloon programs that have been supported in the past. So I'm not entirely clear whether there's an issue of sort of falling in between the cracks here or not.
I don't think. Well, for this conference today here, it may fall between the cracks if you choose to exclude the Earth from the solar system. I'll grant you that, if you choose that. But as far as the proposal is concerned, I don't think it falls into a crack because, it went into a program that supports balloon observations. It's not planetary in nature. It's astrophysical in nature. I don't see it as falling between a crack in that sense, at headquarters. Yes, yeah, there are no other balloon experiments.
Does that make it difficult? I mean, do the balloon programs not recognize that you could do exoplanet missions?
No, the AO says you should do things that are in, what are the words, NASA's charter or NASA, you know, the overall goals, the higher goals of NASA, and looking for planets around nearby stars and planetary systems, and their architecture is written right up there in their charter.
Okay.
Not only that, but astrophysics divided in three groups. One of them exoplanet, and we don't have any.
Right. So it seems like this doesn't actually fall into the sort of category of political issues that we were gonna maybe put in the report, like things that like in, you know, refer to say that the Discovery mission that Chaz mentioned earlier.
Well, maybe I'll disagree in one respect, which is that it's still, as in the course of making this proposal, we felt that the NASA balloon program would be stretching to support, you know, this activity. We had to squeeze their annual funding level was considering experiments that were generally cheaper than this, and so if they live inside the box that they have now, they may find it difficult to support this. Well, not in the current budget plan that we were,
no.
Available funds that they have now, maybe in some time in the past.
My colleague Eric Smith did a similar workshop like this to do CMB, okay, and CMB polarization. And this, like Wes is doing, had shown like three workshops in the last year, right, on exoplanet. They did similar workshop on CMB. And the balloon program, after those workshops, was dominated by CMB balloons. All from Antarctica, and did excellent measurement, including Boomerang, that was in the cover of New York Times and many, many other publications, well, scientific and popular publications. So what I have been talking to Eric Smith, he said now we had to do a workshop to discourage people to do more CMB, because we had way too many, almost dominated both the rocket and the balloon program. So to me, this is good that we're doing this, because this is what Wes had presented, one idea of with this orbital program, and we haven't had this before, so the people have been very tentative in proposing, but I think it's a good trend that we may be able to do more. So CMB is a good example of that, doing workshop and fostering all this collaboration really create a lot of a huge community that have done BLAST, Boomerang, and several other balloon. In fact, what is the balloon by Jamie Bock has a different one that he's doing. But there have been like five or six that have all been very successful. They have flown from Sweden, from Canada, they have flown from New Mexico, flown from Antarctica in Australia. So that was a result of a lot of workshop that headquarters started sponsoring and helping the community, but the community really needed a small push, and they kept on going by themselves.